Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is one that our listeners are going to be familiar with. And in fact, with this episode, I think you have now become our most repeated guest, Jerry Bullard. Welcome back to the show and thanks for joining us again.
Oh, happy to be back by popular demand. Right?
That's absolutely true. You joke, but I've had a lot of people come up to me after we've done these episodes and said that was super helpful because, you know, there's just so much that goes on in the legislature. I think having this kind of post-ledge breakdown is really helpful. Speaking of which, that is our topic today, is we're going to talk about kind of what happened in the Maine and maybe even a couple of special legislative sessions that impacts appellate and trial practitioners.
We couldn't think of a more fitting guest to have as we kind of wind down our summer recess, as it were, and get ramped back up on recording our episodes. And yeah, it's kind of a fitting day to have you back. Although we kind of hold off scheduling for a while because of the special sessions, we weren't sure if there was going to be something new that might come out of those. But we're glad to have you back, Jerry, and looking forward to getting your insights on things that passed and how they're going to affect certainly Texas trial lawyers, but a lot of interesting appellate stuff in there too.
Yeah, there's plenty of appellate points to be addressed in some of these bills, and some of them, you know, are just interesting just for other reasons, and we can talk about a few of those. So do you want me to give you a little bit of overview?
Yeah, let's do that. I'm kind of curious about the numbers and kind of what ended up coming in and out of the session both.
Okay, well, I'm happy to do that. This session, there were over 8,150 bills that were filed, and that's the highest ever. So we set a record. Woo! As I was reading through all of these bills, and I don't read everything from front page to back page when they're filed. I just can't do it. It's just not physically possible, but I do scan them all. And boy, it sure felt like there were a lot of them getting filed. I knew we were going to hit some sort of record. And certainly we did. It's 800 more filed than the previous record high of, like, in 2009.
Wow.
So there was a lot of bills getting filed, a lot of work to be done. And at the end of the day, only, so I think my number is 1,246 passed, so which seemed to me to be kind of a low number for passage rates. It turns out it's like the third lowest since 1995. So I had a lot going into the funnel at the beginning. That funnel really got narrow at the end, and not a whole lot happened in terms of numbers. But at the same time, a whole lot happened with those that did pass. And we can certainly talk about those as we move forward. When I talk to legislators and staffers, and even those paying attention, everybody liked to use the word unprecedented. This was an unprecedented session. Of course, we hear that word a lot, so I'm not sure what makes this one more unprecedented than others. But the feedback was unprecedented in terms of a lot of folks felt that the level of scrutiny given to our civil justice system seemed to have been amped up a bit. And some bills came out of that, and we'll talk about those, obviously, like I already mentioned in a second. But it's also unprecedented because we had a House member get expelled, and we have an impeachment that's going to start up this month. And so next week, you're right. And so, you know, those things have make it really, really, really unprecedented. So anyway, but, you know, there's a lot going on.
And then we had a couple of special sessions too, and it looks like maybe more before this is all said and done with.
Yeah, we had one special session that didn't really result in anything because of the stalemate. It had to do with ad valorem taxes, and there's a few other matters that were on the agenda. But the main one dealt with property tax relief. Second special session got that dealt with. Well, that didn't sound right. That got dealt with in the second session. But there will be another, probably in October after the impeachment proceedings. It'll probably focus on, at least the word is, it'll focus on education, vouchers, things along those lines. Some of the bills that got vetoed at the end of the regular session may show up on the special session agenda because the governor essentially said, I'm vetoing these bills because we need to deal with property taxes. Property taxes got dealt with. So I bet we'll see some of those things on the special agenda. And judicial compensation could make an appearance in the next special. I don't think anybody's holding their breath, but there is some talk that could happen. So yeah, there could be more to come. We'll see if that comes to fruition. But one thing I did want to talk about real bit as part of our background and our setup, every session there's legislative priorities. And I always like to take a look at those going in because it always gives you an idea of what's going to attract the legislature's attention. Is good stuff going to fall by the wayside because something else is happening, or is bad stuff going to creep in because no one's paying attention? This regular session was no exception. There were things like property tax reduction, like we talked about. There was school safety, public ed. Some of these are always on the agenda, but there were like three items that really caught my attention that showed up on some leader, state leader lists. Like the lieutenant governor had an emphasis on proposing legislation to deal with rogue district attorneys and rogue judges. And the rogue definition was always not following Texas law, whatever that meant, you know, going in. But there were a few bills to deal with that issue. And we'll talk about one perhaps as we go through this podcast. But the one at the end with that I have my last bullet point when I do these priorities dealt with the creation of a business trial court. And that did happen this session. So that one's gotten a lot of attention from trial lawyers, appellate lawyers, and just about anybody else who's interested in that issue, because it's one of those frequent flyer bills that kept coming back and finally got across the finish line this time. So
I'm pretty sure we've talked about that issue in previous episodes with you, Jerry, and it got to where it was like, oh yeah, here it comes again. And it seemed like that was just going to continue to come up until it finally got pushed through.
Yeah, you're right. It's always kept showing up. It was always in a different iteration. You know, it seemed like there were some tweaks to it. But this session, it was a priority for everybody in terms of state leaders. The lieutenant governor wanted it done. The governor wanted it done. The speaker wanted it done. Of course, you had business interests, business organizations that were urging its passing and have been for a while. So it was going to get passed. It was HB 19. It had a low bill number. So we knew it had a priority associated with it. So do you want to dive into that one, or we can do whatever, whatever direction you want to go.
Let's kind of talk about the nuts and bolts of that a little bit, because it's interesting. And I'm kind of curious your take on how much we think it's going to get used, given kind of the way that it's set up.
Well, it's like a 23-page bill. So there's a lot of details in it. Essentially, let's talk about basically what it's going to do. It creates a specialized business court, just like it sounds. It's going to hear almost exclusively business-related litigation cases. And we're talking about things like disputes between business owners. It'll be high-dollar contract-type disputes. There's some sort of disputes between, you know, members, shareholders, things along those lines. It's supposed to cover those types of disputes. There are three tiers when you talk about the jurisdiction that goes along with the bill. There's one I call tier one, that's $10 million in controversy. And those are primarily your commercial disputes. There's a $5 million in controversy that deals with business governance issues. However, that $5 million amount of controversy requirement doesn't apply if one of the parties is a publicly traded company. And then there's a supplemental jurisdiction piece where that's kind of a catch-all. As long as it fits within one of these other categories, parties can agree to have it brought over into the business court. So you've got the way the jurisdiction is defined. There's a lot of things in that, but there's also a whole lot that's been excluded, like claims of the DTPA, family code disputes, states code matters. I mean, there's a laundry list of areas that's not covered by that bill. So back to your original comment about how many cases this is going to capture, you know, no one really knows what those numbers are. The Office of Court Administration hasn't kept those numbers to figure out if it would fall within these jurisdictional parameters. So everybody's got that question mark is how many cases it's really going to take on, because I'm not sure how many that really
is. Well, I'm not either. And my comment was not at all doubtful that it's not going to work. I truly just don't know. Yeah. There may be more $5 and $10 million disputes out there than we realize. It's just hard to say. And one of the things I know you have talked about before is the rollout. Looks like it kind of starts in big cities and then maybe moves to some of the smaller areas as sort of a test case.
Yeah, what was interesting about the bill, and this is one of those that evolved into what it ended up being when it passed, where you've got these courts that are being created according to the administrative judicial regions that we have in Texas. And there are 11 of those, if I remember right. So I have a little map in front of me that I could look at to tell me all those things. So you've got those jurisdictional parameters already set in place that these courts are going to be within. In the bill, they're called divisions. And so on September 1 of 2024, you're going to have these courts created in divisions 1, 3, 4, 8, and 11, which if you got an urban hub associated with each one, it'd be Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, Fort Worth, and Houston. Each of those areas are going to have two business court judges assigned to them. All the other administrative regions, there's a provision in the bill that says, well, the legislature funds those. And if they do so, by September 1, 2026, i.e. by next session, then they will come into existence. But if not, they go away. And the scuttlebutt was, well, it seemed like most of the urban areas are really one of these business courts needed to be anyway in the minds of legislators and a lot of rural areas. And those constituents said, you know, we don't need one of those out here. We like our judges. We like them to have all these cases. And so perhaps that's where they decided to have this tiered approach in terms of implementing this court. So it's very interesting to me.
It is. And it's also not going to be maybe the only non-elected judge position in Texas that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, we have some appointees, I guess like masters and things like that. But as far as district judges, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's going to be a judicial appointment. They're appointed for 2-year terms. So, I mean, there's a question there. I mean, most of us have involved in litigation for any period of time. No, you got cases that go a whole lot longer than 2 years.
So,
yeah, for sure.
So you're going to have a judge that's going to, the one that starts it, is he or she going to be the one who finishes it? Because there's a reappointment process that goes along with that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a whole lot of interesting aspects of this bill that have yet to be flushed out.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
I'm curious about the divisions, skipping numbers when the numbers that you rattled off don't really seem to align with like the Court of Appeals districts or the administrative districts. What's the rhyme or reason to that?
Well, they are supposed to align with all the administrative districts. And I think,
okay.
I mean, at one time there was a thought about making them align with 14 courts of appeals or those appellate districts, but I guess they decided it made more sense to do it according to administration judicial regions. For administrative purposes, perhaps, I don't know, but maybe it's just an easier sell for legislators to vote on. They do correspond to those administrative regions.
And of course, you mentioned the appointments, and I think the obvious issue there is that there's been some serious question about whether this statute, whether these courts, by definition, would be constitutional.
Yeah.
Because our Constitution requires our judges to be elected.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interesting. Inevitably, be some challenges, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and there's no question that we'll see some challenges. I'm just curious when and where and who. This is going to have to be somebody whose ox gets gored first before they're going to decide they want to challenge it, you know? But yeah, I mean, that was a battle. And I think some of these tweaks by creating some of these courts and calling them divisions, there were some nomenclature changes, I think, perhaps to help ward off constitutional challenges. Instead of calling it a statewide district court, it's going to be the business court created by division. So all sorts of little nuances there that make you wonder if that's going to help it withstand that sort of a challenge. And the other part of this court is also the judges that would be appointed. There are specific qualifications for them. I think the legislature obviously wanted the judges sitting on these courts to have the type of experience and background to handle these, what everyone thinks will be complex business disputes. So the judges will have to have been licensed for at least 10 years, practice complex civil business litigation, or practice business transaction law. And so you've got some qualifications for these judges that our other judges don't have.
Transaction law, how is that going to impact it? I mean, we'd like to think that our judges have experience in litigation, and I get the complex litigation, but I'm not sure that the average complex transactional lawyer would be a good fit for a court.
Well, yeah, I would agree with you. Although, you know, I do a lot more transactional work than I used to after being just solely litigation for a while. Well, I had to learn a lot, but at the same time, I was able to appreciate the litigation nuances after having to do some transactional work and vice versa. I mean, it's worked the same way, but yeah, I would be concerned if no disrespect to any of my transactional brethren and sisters, you know, brothers and sisters in law. It's a different ballgame.
This may be my last follow-up question on this, but we've got the divisions, and I know with respect to other aspects of this bill and another one that we're going to get to, I'm sure, later, which is the 15th Court of Appeals, the ones that are being rolled out in 24, have those been funded? I know that was a big issue with passing this without funding.
Well, the legislature has appropriation provision, or maybe a supplemental appropriation bill to fund these particular courts. So that was part of the budget that was passed to fund just these urban area courts. I forgot what that fiscal note was, but it's not insignificant. And there's still a question whether or not that's sufficient to fund this. Those are questions that have yet to be answered. One other part of this court that was interesting is that the Supreme Court's going to be adopting rules about opinion writing. So some of these trial judges are going to be writing opinions on some of their disputes, I guess. Maybe the rules will help decide when when those opinions are supposed to be written. I guess it'll be complex novel issues or something like that, but that's different.
Well, what about staff, Jerry? Because we know most of our trial judges don't write opinions, and the ones that do write orders usually have the benefit of having staff available to help them with that. We're at least used to that in terms of the federal model and obviously our upper level courts. But I'm trying to picture a lot of the trial judges I know are far too busy to sit down and write opinions. So it's going to be interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah, well, there's supposed to be nothing there for staff, too. Staff attorneys and having the facilities that are in the courtroom to handle these types of disputes. And so there is a piece of this that provides staffing to go along with this court. So once again, this is supposed to be one of those field of dreams type deals, right? If they build it, they will come. The idea is to attract more businesses to Texas and more corporate formations here in Texas. But the idea, if we have a business court that specializes in these disputes and perhaps help more people incorporate in Texas versus Delaware or wherever else they go. So the legislature has thought about these things. There's going to have to be some tweaking done once this thing's in place. And Chairman Leach, who was a chair of the House Judiciary and Civil Jurisprudence Committee, who's a lawyer, I spoke at a CLE with him. Was it last month, I guess it was? And he said, you know, there's no perfect bill. He said, I certainly anticipate we'll have to tweak this one as it moves forward. So.
Well, let's kind of transition into something that Todd previewed, which is the 15th Court of Appeals, because I think that dovetails a little bit with the business courts bill.
Yes, it does. That was a different twist on this particular business court bill as opposed to previous ones, because usually we had a creation of a business trial court and a business appellate court. That business appellate court piece went away. In its place, we have a provision in this bill that would make all of these business trial court appeals go to a newly created 15th Court of Appeals. And the 15th Court of Appeals is intended to be a statewide appellate district court. And those judges would be elected, although the initial judges, I think there would be three initially, according to the legislation, three initially appointed. But it's really supposed to be five judges at the end of the day, where they would be appointed to start sitting on this court and hearing the cases that are covered by the jurisdictional grants in the statute. And the jurisdictional grant deals with the civil cases involving the state agencies, state officers acting within their, the color of state law or acting within their scope of authority. If anybody challenges the constitutionality of a statute, it goes to this court, provided that the AG has stepped in to defend that statute, and all the appeals from the business court would go to the statewide court of appeals. That's a new one. But once again, it was a bill. This was Senate Bill 1045. It had a high bill number, but it was linked to HB 519, you know, the business court bill. So it was going to get passed too. It passed with flying colors, at least out of the committee. There were some Democrats that it started out as not a bipartisan bill, but there were several Democrats that crossed over and voted for the Court of Appeals, which I thought was interesting. Same thing with the business court. Anyway, this is another one of those nuances in the legislation that's passed. It's caused a lot of folks to wonder, why are we doing this? You know.
Yeah, I'm interested in some of the logistical pieces of this one. I mean, I assume the judges on this court could probably come from anywhere in the state, but it'll sit in Austin, which I guess will be somewhere in the Supreme Court, Third Court of Appeals complex, probably would be my guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be my guess, too. Yeah, these would be elected judges elected statewide. So you're going to see more statewide judicial campaigns, and they can come from anywhere. But as far as actually sitting, like you said, Jody, they can, you know, it's primarily in Austin, but they could sit anywhere.
Yeah, I'm also interested to see how we're going to cite to it, because 1 through 14 TexApp, that's pretty well settled. But for a statewide appellate court, I'm not quite sure how that's going to work.
Yeah, well, I guess it could be TexApp 15, right? Or something like that. Right? You know, I guess that's what it would be.
Texas Law Review. UT Law Review people.
I was going to say,
figure out.
Texas Law Review people better get rolling on that and publish something in the Green Book.
Yeah, well, something interesting about this one, too, is that this is a bill or a court that's going to be created on September 1, 2024. But interesting about this one is that, you know, the notice of appeals, what triggers the application of a case getting to the Court of Appeals, the 15th Court, once it's filed. But there's a provision in the bill that says that, you know, cases that were filed that within the court's jurisdiction between September 1, 2023 and September 1, 2024, those will get transferred into this court. So I'm kind of wondering, okay, so many other courts, if they initially get an appeal that this court is supposed to get within the jurisdiction, what do they do during that whole year or half a year? Do they brief it up and then it gets transferred over and decided by this court? Or what? I don't know. I mean, I know the Supreme Court Advisory Committee is working on rules for the business court and this one, even as we speak. So I guess we'll flush some of those things out by rule.
Yeah, SCAC's been a little bit busy lately, I would say.
I forgot how many bills I got sent to them to mess with, propose rules or tweaks to, but it was quite a voluminous stack if you had to print all that on paper. But
so, I mean, we know how it goes when there's a vacancy and the governor appoints and the rest of the courts of appeals, the Supreme Court. I mean, the appointee then has to run in the next general election. Is it set up similar to that with the 15th court? Or is it more like you're appointed to an initial 2-year term and then after that's got to be elected?
Yeah, I would think, and if it's going to go into effect and start up on September 1, 2024, there's going to have to be an appointment for, like I said, 3 judges initially, and they would have to run the next general election. And I don't know if the other two, if there'd be a phase in. I'm sure there's a provision in the bill that makes amendments to the government code that deals with, you know, what place they're in and when they have to run, so these terms would be staggered. Well,
yeah, because, I mean, the Third Court of Appeals here in Austin is a bit of an anomaly because of 6 judges, there are 4 of them that are up in the same election cycle. Well, it would be pretty disruptive if you turned over all 3 justices on the 15th Court of Appeals at the same time. It'd be nice to have them staggered, I would think.
Yeah, and I'll confess, I haven't really looked at that as far as how those positions would be staggered. I'm sure it's addressed in the bill somewhere.
It's okay. Yeah. I like to place stump the expert. So
that's right.
I wouldn't know the answer. It's why I'm asking, Jerry.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I believe there is a provision for that that deals with the number of judges and when they would start, but I'd have to go back and refresh my memory to give any details on it. So
this is no ill performance on your part, Jerry, as always.
No, I appreciate it. That is a question I need to know the answer to because it will get asked again, I know.
Yep. Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
Another one that I think is kind of a minor change, but one that's going to be important to those of us that do appeals a whole lot, is the bill about changing the permissive appeal statute to require reasons, which I think will be an interesting one.
Oh, yeah. That was one most of us were tracking. Whenever I see a bill get filed that attracts my attention, I'm wondering what's behind it, right?
Or who, yeah.
You know, why is it filed? Who filed it? This one has a relatively easy response. There was a Supreme Court case, and y'all may recall this, Industrial Specialist versus Blanchard, where we had, it was like a 3-2-3 split, where we had 3 judges saying, well, our current rules do not require the Court of Appeal to specify why it will not accept a permissive appeal when the parties have agreed to it, and the trial court has agreed to it. And then there were 3 members of the Supreme Court who said, no, you need to tell us why you're denying this petition, this request for permissive appeal. And so, and then there was all those in between said, yeah, it'd be nice to have that, but the rules don't require it. We can't make them do it, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We had 2 bills filed to deal with this very issue, and SB 1603 is the one that passed. And now the Court of Appeals is going to be required to state why they're not accepting a permissive appeal once it reaches that particular court. And if they don't do it, then the Supreme Court can do a de novo review and say, no, we think it met the standard. You need to tell us why you didn't accept
it.
And send it back to the Court of Appeals, say, tell us what you're thinking. This bill was almost unanimously passed on both sides, both chambers. It was non-controversial, but I'm always interested to know what the feedback is and what the thought process is when the legislature creates more work for the Court of Appeals, but yet necessarily give them the funding to move these things along. This is another example.
I agree. It should be non-controversial because it just makes sense. I mean, I've studied this issue more closely than some of the other changes, and I love some of the terminology used in some of those opinions out of the Supreme Court, that it was an unsatisfactory escape hatch for the Supreme Court to take jurisdiction over a case that the Court of Appeals had turned away on permissive appeal, because then you don't have the benefit of Court of Appeals thought process and reasoning. And so that was, I think, kind of an obvious reason for the change. And also the fact that there were certain courts that had gotten in such the habit of just summarily denying permissive appeals that they were repeating typographical errors from one appeal to another. So I personally love this change. I think any opportunity for appellate lawyers to be in trial courts and help to get issues that are important to deciding the cases in front of appellate courts quickly so that hopefully the parties can spend less money overall on the litigation. And frankly, unabashedly give appellate lawyers more work is great. I think it's a matter of making the trial lawyers aware of this change and then how to make it palatable to the client. I think ultimately the long-term cost savings of taking a shot at permissive appeal when you're looking at years of litigation mm-hmm. and the possibility of avoiding that. And then only then being able to tee up the issue and an appeal from the final judgment. And then if you're the one appealing most of the time, it's going to be a really bad outcome that you've had to suffer to get there. So this change makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I'm kind of excited about it because I think it opens up new doors for us as appellate lawyers.
No, I agree. I like the change. And I think it's a great tool to have in the toolbox because I know we've all experienced the frustration of trying to get one of these things granted. The court of appeals say no, no thank you. Even though the parties and the trial court, it's something that needs to happen to help resolve a case early on, or potentially resolve it. So I think it's a good tool to have. Once again, I am a little sympathetic to the courts. If they're not getting funding, yeah. they need to help process these things because there's an appeal going up the ladder, but sometimes it's going to take a while to get an answer sometimes.
Yeah.
True. But in the end, I think having a little bit of precedential guidance on some of this stuff and how courts of appeals look at it may ultimately reduce the number of permissive appeals or at least give us some better parameters because now you just sort of shoot your shot and you either get it or you don't and there's no real explanation. So having some thought process behind it outlined in opinions may help us all out a little bit.
And I've heard a few appellate judges saying, it may have been from transcripts of the Supreme Court Advisory Committee meeting where they were talking about, aren't they kind of telegraphing rulings on certain issues if they don't mm-hmm. things that they don't consider to be important or there's a little bit of concern there. There's a high wire act a little bit the Court of Appeals are gonna have to walk to say what they depending on how they rule these things. Those were some good questions that were brought up. I haven't really thought through those what answers ought to be to those questions.
Yeah, I think the key to that is you keep your opinion as narrow as possible, only addressing the issue that's in front of you. And that, again, is one of the jobs of appellate counsels to help define that question in a way that will be more likely for the Court of Appeals to accept it and persuasive to the Court of Appeals. It truly does meet the statutory standards for permissive appeal.
That's a true point. It's a good point.
So one of the ones that I thought was just kind of interesting that is not so much affecting our daily practice, but the kind of extension to Judicial Conduct Commission authority over judicial candidates, which, I mean, admittedly, I didn't realize they didn't already have that authority, but it's kind of an interesting issue.
Yeah, that's HB 367. That's one I thought was interesting, too. I think it was last session, the legislature passed a constitutional amendment that everyone voted on, but essentially gave the State Commission on Judicial Conduct authority over judicial candidates, right? So those candidates were going to be subject to the same standards as an incumbent judge as to what they could and couldn't do on the campaign trail. So we have an amendment to deal with that, but there wasn't any statutory authority given to the commission to do whatever it is they need to do. So I guess this bill was intended to provide that was an enabling statute to allow mm-hmm. them to basically, hey, you guys got authority to deal with judicial candidates too. And I've seen, you may have too, I mean, I've seen judicial candidates go out and say all sorts of stuff.
Yep.
That if they were, mm-hmm. if they had a robe mm-hmm. and they were on the bench, they couldn't say, like endorsing other candidates, which mm-hmm. incumbents can't do, but judicial candidates can, and so it needed to be dealt with. And I think this is supposed to be given the commission authority to do that. So what happens though to those complaints that I know they're out there that have been filed on some of these candidates before the statute went into effect, but after the constitutional amendment was passed, I don't know what the commission is going to do with those. But anyway, they have some authority statutorily to take care of those situations. Another non-controversial bill, by the way, I think it passed both chambers unanimously or near unanimously.
Well, I think that one's probably one that needed to happen. Like I said, I guess I just sort of always thought they regulated judicial candidates, but I didn't realize that they didn't. Yeah. So I'm glad. It's just interesting.
Well, I think for a period of time, there was a question as to whether they had that authority or not, mm-hmm. but they do now.
Yeah, probably a good change.
Yeah.
If those are talking about these little bills with nuances, let's talk about the omnibus court bit a little bit. We did talk about it in terms of the appellate record, but for trial lawyers, there's a nice little nugget in there that's not going to require all courts, trial and appellate, to make sure any orders they sign or judgments they enter get sent to the parties who are parties of the case by e-filing if they're part of the electronic filing system. Once again, that's one of those that we all think they should have been doing a long time ago.
Thank most goodness. Of them did. It's about time.
I'm so happy about this.
You know, it's one of those that seemed to make sense, you know, and sometimes I assumed it happened because, you know, where I practice in Tarrant County, they're pretty good about sending those things out on a regular basis. Yeah.
No, I think that's true, but that is certainly not universal across 254 counties. I can tell you for sure.
I think same. I think I'm finding out that perhaps we're an exception to the general rule in a lot of ways, you know, not across the board. But anyway, that was part of that omnibus court bill that passed. And so,
It's been a minute or two on that. That one is, I think, has a huge impact for lots of reasons. I mean, I think it's going to cut down on the number of 306A motions that have to be filed. When it really truly was a problem that parties were not getting copies of orders and even final judgments. And you would have to go, particularly in some rural counties that we will not call out by name, literally parties would have to go and have staff like regularly monitor the court dockets to see if an order had been signed. And that was just an immense waste of staff time. This cures that, although it does put on the clerk the burden of making sure that those orders are sent electronically. And so what I don't know yet, and I will know probably within a few weeks, is how this has been rolled out and presented to the clerks. And so we will see if there's compliance right away, because you want to be able to count on the clerks doing what they're charged with doing. The other big feature of this, though, the thing that I think is really going to be significant about it, is if you use the platform Research Texas at all, you know that that was one of the downsides to it, is that court orders were not there. You could go and get all kinds of pleadings easily downloaded from that site. And now, by virtue of sending the orders through the e-filing system, it cross your fingers, but it should cure that omission in Research Texas, so that that platform eventually hopefully fulfills the promise it had of being truly a PACER-like system for equivalent for Texas state courts. And if you talk to Blake Hawthorne, he would probably say yes. And eventually, hopefully, that's going to really streamline and simplify the getting appellate records up to appellate courts, because it's going to be far more like what we see in federal court, which is essentially just the whole record just gets duped and sent up.
Yeah.
Which actually, Jerry, you mentioned this, but I don't know if we talked about this once we started recording, but there is a new rule that impacts appellate records that was part of the omnibus bill as well.
The appendix that we were talking
about? Yeah, I think we talked about that before we hit record, but I don't know that we've actually mentioned it since we started recording.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, maybe we did talk about that in the green room, as they say, right?
That's right.
But yeah, now the parties have it available if they're going to appeal to create an appendix in lieu of a clerk's record. And that will allow parties, it started out just being solely, the bill did solely for appellants, but then it was applied to both parties, where if party wants to go up on appeal, they want to do an appendix in lieu of the clerk's record, i.e. instead of requesting a record be prepared by the clerk of the court, they have to notify the court of appeals within 10 days after the notice of appeal is filed that they intend to use an appendix. And once they make that designation, then that appendix will be due when that brief is filed. Or I guess it's 30 days filed with the brief, and the brief is going to be due 30 days after notice the designation is done, or the reporter's record is filed, whichever is later. The bottom line is it allows the parties to designate what they want to have in clerk's record going up on appeal. You know, there are provisions in the bill that say it has to be a file mark copy of whatever's been filed in the trial court. But there's always going to be those circumstances where I guess there's going to be concern whether or not what's getting filed as this appendix is going to be complete. It's going to cover actually what the trial court had in front of it. But for many people, this is a welcome change because they don't have to pay for the clerk's record to be prepared. This bill also says that if someone designates an appendix instead of a clerk's record, that the clerk can't charge those, can't charge the parties for that, for the preparation of that record. So there's a lot of folks who wanted that to happen. I know there's, like we've talked about before, and others have said it to me too, so that we're not sure what this is going to look like.
Yeah.
Just preparing a mandamus record, for example, always has had problems where parties have been, hadn't been able to do something similar. Mm-hmm. To this, but now it's going to apply to regular appeals.
This was going to require a rule change. So have we seen the order or the rule on that yet? I know the Supreme Court's been announcing a bunch of new rules recently, and I just hadn't come across this one.
Yeah, there have been, they are working on rules. And I think if we were to go back and look at the Supreme Court Advisory Committee agenda documents, I think proposed rules are there as recent as whatever the last meeting was, 2 weeks ago. So I think they're out there, but they've not been published for public comment or anything yet. But a lot of these questions we're talking about in terms of making sure the record, whatever is filed, is true and a correct copy and all that other good stuff, the rules deal with some of those things. I think it deals with presumptions too, that if if someone has an appendix and they designated it, and the presumption is going to be whatever's left behind supports the judgment of the court, of the trial court. I mean, those sorts of things. I think the rules are going to deal with that. I've not seen the latest iteration, but I remember one committee member saying, yeah, they had talked about that and that was going to be dealt with, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, that may cure some of my concerns, because I think overall this is a great idea and a huge one for access to justice. But my concern is the way the bill reads, it prohibits any filing of any clerk's record, which sort of leaves you back in this weird mandamus land where people have to designate, cross-designate and all that. And as any of us who have done that for any length of time know, that just can really create a big mess.
Yeah,
I agree with that. And we do need to be looking out for the rules. Like I said, I think there are drafts floating around out there that are available. We just have to go get them.
One thing that the court's been doing is when they've been issuing these rules following up on the last session, they've been announcing that the rule is effective September 1, but it's still leaving it open for public comment.
Yep.
So whenever the court does issue a rule on this, I would expect it to be effective immediately. And then before they actually publish it in the books, it can be tweaked. We're all on notice. I mean, there's a rules section of the Supreme Court's website. So if in doubt, folks should go there and look and make sure that whether there is or isn't a rule yet announced on this.
Yeah.
And while we're talking about rules, and I think Todd and I'll do a little bit deeper dive on this in a future episode, but there's been some changes to bonds as well that came out of this session relating to alternate security. They gave a little bit of clarification on when that's to be used. Approval of bonds, the court does not have to approve it anymore. It's effective on filing. And then the one that I think is a big deal for those of us that practice appeals is actually now, if you take a case on appeal and you prevail in the intermediate court of appeals, even though the case isn't over, you can revisit the bond in the trial court based on that disposition, which was a change that was a long time needed. So I'm glad that they finally did that.
Yeah, I think that was HB 4381 deals with the supersedious issues. I think there was also provision there. Like you said, it's probably a good topic for discussion, just an episode all on its own.
Yeah.
But it allows a judgment debtor, you know, to basically say, look, I can't even post the bond that I'd otherwise required to post unless I start selling off things and liquidating assets. And there's a provision that gives a judgment debtor relief for not having to do those things if it's going to require them to go off and liquidate a bunch of things, which creates a whole lot of different issues in terms of discovery and whether they, you know, the net worth issue. That's a whole other can of worms, I guess, potentially.
Yeah.
But I think that sounds like a good way to deal with some of these appeals that people want to appeal, debtors want to appeal, but they can't post the bond, you know.
I did notice that's true.
One provision of that bill in the new rules is the removal of the requirement that the clerk approve the bond. Which is a good change, because how many times have we had to go down to the clerk's office and physically find the right clerk to just sign something that their signature didn't actually affect anything? It was just a requirement in the rules. And if you had a clerk who, for whatever reason, didn't want to approve your bond, it affected your ability to supersede the judgment. So the nice thing about it, there's still the fail safe, of course, that if once the bond's filed, it can be questioned and it can be brought up in a hearing with the trial judge. Trial judge is always the one that ought to be making decisions, and not court staff works really hard and do a great job, but let's not put non-lawyers in the position of making a decision that impacts the party's legal rights.
And it's funny you mentioned this topic, because I had the practitioner in another part of the state pose a question. I think they may have been on a social media platform saying, hey, you know, the rules really don't tell us how to, you know, we talk about supersedious bonds and how much they need to be, but how to really physically file something in the trial court and what we need to do. And you know, the rules are unclear on that. And so I got to thinking, I don't know that I've seen many talks on that as far as the physical process one would go through. And I had one we had posted a bond for way back when, and I was able to send her an example of that one, but it had to get the clerk's approval, what have you. But all that to say is that's a good topic for another day, just on the mechanics of that.
You know? Yeah, Todd and I love to nerd out on supersedious. So we've already talked offline about having kind of a featured episode coming up on some of these changes and how that works, because I think that's exactly right.
We get irrationally excited about a very dry topic.
Which is actually how we started the podcast, pretty much to cover those types of things. I'm so
guilty of those things too. So, just don't get me started on some of the nuances of this proceeding that's going to happen in September, the impeachment deal, because I'll go down that trail real easy. So that's another topic.
I'm not sure we'll dedicate an episode to that.
Yeah.
But no, that may be a good after the fact one involving some of those that were involved just for the historical component too. But anyway, Didn't mean to sidetrack you.
No, we're good.
Another bill that did pass real quick while I'm thinking about it that we all knew was going to happen. It's the Unauthorized Disclosure of Judicial Opinions, SB 372. After Dobbs and the leak of the draft of the opinion, our legislature decided we needed to pass a law to make that a Class A misdemeanor if anybody does such a thing. There were those who thought that we already had that protection on the books, but I guess there was a question whether we did or not, but now we have a law. And the question that gets asked to me is, if you read that bill, that unauthorized disclosure and thou shalt not disclose applies to everybody except the judges. And I've had folks say, why is that the case? And I said, you know, I really don't know, but it applies to everybody else. And it may be because that's covered by the judicial canons.
Yeah.
Judges can't do that. So anyway, but that's one everybody knew was coming. It's happening nationwide. But that's just a little tying that issue up in a nice little bow as far as we're concerned. And both of y'all having served on courts as staff attorneys and briefing attorneys, y'all know what that means. That was always a thou shalt not, and y'all didn't worry about that. But I guess
it's kind of one of those. It's sort of like the judicial candidate thing. I guess I never really thought about the fact that there wasn't a law that covered that, because it just never crossed my mind that anyone would do that anyway. So,
like I said, that's one of those that sailed through, and everybody knew it would.
I think that makes sense. This is kind of an obscure one that really does not impact our practice, but I saw that there's some data collection bills on judicial statistics that's going to require them to drill down to some more specific levels, which I think ought to be interesting, because I always love looking at those stats on, as it is now, there's such aggregate level statistics that a lot of times you can't tell much about it. But I think having some more detailed statistical information is going to be helpful, especially when your clients ask about certain types of cases and that kind of stuff.
I mean, this is supposed to create a uniform way of doing these things. HB 841 is the bill that you're taught, at least one of the bills where it's going to require that case level data be kept, and judicial counsel is going to keep track of those things. The rules are going to have to come up, be adopted to talk about how that's going to be collected and stored. I guess a lot of this is going to require district clerks to do more work to identify these cases and categorize them and what have you. And some counties do a better job than others in that, so I'm told. But yeah, I mean, that will be helpful information, especially when a legislature decides they need to create another court, create another specialized court. If they need some data to rely upon to justify that, because like the business court issue and the Court of Appeals, there was a lot of questions asked, why do we need this? Is there data to support it? And no one was able to bring the legislature any data. So this should help with those situations. But the nerds like us, it'll be like Christmas Day, right?
Oh, we can feed that information into ChatGPT and get it to tell us the problem. I mean, come on.
I think that is good, though, because when you have clients ask you, hey, what about these types of cases and appeals and all that kind of stuff? And as it is now, I can find very general civil statistics about stuff, but you can't go much deeper than that. And I think it's kind of nice to be able to cut it at that level. And it ought to help Kent Rutter and those people when they update their papers, too, about which cases are going where and how they're getting decided. Instead of having to read every one of them, they may be able to do it on a little bit better basis.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're just all guessing. It's all anecdotal. So it'll be nice to see some numbers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think we've kind of gone through the list that I had. Is there anything else that you've got on your list, Jerry, that we don't want to leave out?
Well, no. I mean, there's always the fun ones, the ones that interest me just because of the process. I don't know how much time we have left, but I could touch
on a few minutes if you want to run through.
Yeah.
Sometimes we all wonder how come it takes so long for a bill to get passed and a session, why the legislature moves slow. And we say it's all part of the process. And sometimes it takes multiple sessions, but there was a bill that was passed that dealt with online ticket sales, SB 1639. And what it does essentially is it prohibits the creation or use of bots purchase tickets for concerts or whatever online. Now, three guesses as to what motivated that bill.
It's the Taylor Swift bill.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how long. It may have been a matter of minutes. It was probably a few days after that whole debacle that this bill was filed in the Senate. The Senator Zaffarini filed that bill. I mean, and it swiftly moved through the process. But I mean, it was one of those that no one had problems with. But I mean, it was quickly heard, voted on, passed. Okay. So, and there was also another bill, Senate Bill 58, the online sale of goods, same type of deal, no bots, and there's prohibitions against that. I mean, that one passed too. But the online ticket sales deal was interesting. There was a provision in the omnibus courts bill that now prohibits process servers from serving legislators during legislative proceedings. And once again, you may wonder, okay, why come? What happened there? Well, Chairman Leach had a hearing on a bill in which a gentleman showed up, said he was going to testify either on support or in opposition to the bill. And I can't remember what it was. He signs the form, goes into the committee hearing, and he's called up, says what he's going to testify to. And then he also says, oh, and Chairman Leach, you've been served with a lawsuit. And it's a lawsuit that was filed out in West Texas. It was an anti-SLAPP type of deal. It ended up getting dismissed recently. I mean, it wasn't too long after that that the omnibus court bill got amended to deal with that. And now there's a prohibition against that happening. So that's a one-off. It'll probably never happen again. But once again, the legislature can act quickly when it wants to. So now process servers can't do that anymore. And if they do, the citation of the service is quashed and they lose their certification. So, like I said, it was really one of those really quickly filed and passed bills. So,
teeth in that for the process server. Wow.
Yeah. And of course, the process server got read the Riot Act a little bit about it. You realize you just committed perjury and say you're a testifier. So, there's a whole lot of fallout to that, I'm sure, that I don't know about yet. But anyway, it's an interesting stuff. See, there's these little neat little stories that come out.
Yeah, that is an interesting one. That's kind of, you wouldn't think about that, but.
No, I wouldn't think. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that I would be brave enough to even try that. But in the political environment we're in.
Right.
Yeah. People do strange things. So,
well, that's true.
Well, and this is the political element that we cover in these recurring episodes of our show. And Jerry, you know, we're just so grateful to you for coming back again. I think our listeners can pretty much count on at this point every session year that we're going to have one episode early that talks about what we're anticipating out of the session. And then we get to evaluate at the end whether your crystal ball predictions are accurate and where things lay after the whole thing is said and done. And so you just do a tremendous job, as we've said here before, in tracking bills and keeping lawyers and others informed about what's going on. So thank you again, Jerry, for what you do. Yes. And for being willing to come back and spend some time with us. I know there are lots of other folks around the state who are going to get to hear your insights on what we just went through with the session. And so they should look for those opportunities to come hear you talk about it when you do it live. But we're glad you're able to spend some time with us and put some of these thoughts out there.
I'm happy to do it. Always appreciative that that you gentlemen ask. It's a lot of fun. It takes a lot of time, but it's a public service. I really mean that.
No, it very much is.
Absolutely is. All right. Well, any parting thoughts before we sign off for today, Jerry?
No words of wisdom other than just to try to stay cool, and we'll keep monitoring things because, like I said, there's a proceeding going on this month. There'll be another session. So if we need to reconvene just to cover a little nuance, things like that, I'm happy to do that too.
Oh.
And next time, hopefully I could get a legislator to do it with us. So.
Oh, let's count on that. I know we've talked about that before, and that would be a lot of fun.
Well, I thought about it for this one, but because of what's going on starting next week, it was impossible.
Yeah,
they've got their hands full down there right now.
They sure do.
Well, thank you, Jerry. We really appreciate it.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.